Thank you, Mr. Booth. I was fully anticipating on using both waters today. That was my backup. So I did put together, I was actually diligent this week and got a little bit of a PowerPoint to help us get through this, because if you remember, I mentioned that I had on the schedule for what I would be talking about was getting through the Mark of the Beast. And then I kind of changed direction and decided that what I wanted to do was go through Daniel chapter 2 and then Daniel chapter 7 to give a little bit of a framework, because Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 will help us understand what is actually taking place in Revelation. And so I hope as we go through some of this and actually look at the details of what Daniel goes through in his lifetime and the vision that God gives King Nebuchadnezzar, that it'll give us some details that we can use and better understand what it is that we're reading in Revelation. This is one of the most analyzed and talked about prophecies in the Old Testament. This is something that a lot of people know about. It's really crazy how many different interpretations there are for what this dream means and what this statue means. But when we look at the Bible and we use what God has actually given to us in Scripture, it's relatively obvious. And for us, it's obvious, but it always goes back to that point that what's obvious to us is we know that it's not obvious to everybody else, because God has to specifically open our eyes, open our ears, our minds, our hearts to really understand what His Word is, what the message is, because Satan has put blinders on most of the world. And God has allowed this, and He says until He removes that, people are going to be blinded. And so that's why it's helpful to go through this with that mindset of understanding that without God, we have no hope. It's only by God's grace that we understand all of this, but it's really important, because what we get to and what we conclude about all of this is that we understand that this scripture is a template. This is a template for what we see later on in prophecy and what God has showed us and what we're going to go through. It's taking this point right here at the beginning of Daniel's life all the way down through basically the return of Jesus Christ. Not the first time that Christ came as a human being, but His return. The ultimate kingdom of God coming to the earth and establishing that. As we go through this, it's important to remember that more than three quarters of this prophecy has already taken place. There's still part of it that we're waiting on to be fulfilled, but much of it has already been fulfilled. And it gives us some ability to be able to see what's going to play out later on down the line. So when we think about this, what we're going over, it really isn't new information. I'm not presenting any new facts or anything that's not ever been covered. Well, this is stuff that's been around for quite some time. These are theories that have been around for quite some time. This is the understanding that we've had as a church for quite some time. But it's always important to understand that this is the template. And that's why I wanted to go ahead and go back over it, is because this is the template for what we're going to get into in Revelation 13 and 17. It makes a lot more sense when we really understand what God does here through Daniel and what He's doing with King Nebuchadnezzar and setting this prophecy for several years to come. When we think about Daniel at this time was probably a young teenager. He comes from a royal family. And what it is when we think, you can go ahead and if you haven't opened your Bibles to Daniel 2, we're going to spend all day in Daniel chapter 2. So you can go ahead and open your Bibles here. But it's thought he was really young here, and it's because of what the Babylonians did. There was a pattern that they had for when they conquered people of what they did, and they would end up taking the young, the bright, the royal, and they would take these best from the areas, they would take them back to Babylon, they would raise them, they would educate them, and then they'd send them home. Why would they do that? What would be the point of sending them back home after raising them, spending all this time? It was to indoctrinate everybody else. These were the ones that had some sort of power. They came from better families, and so they knew that they would go back into these positions. And so the idea was that they would use their power that they had back in their homelands, and they'd use all of this education that they received in Babylon, and that is what they would implement into the societies. And so it's basically indoctrinating everybody else around them. And so that's what their idea was of why they did this. So we have this fairly early on. We know this is fairly early on, and it puts it kind of around 604, 605 BC. And we know this because of when King Nebuchadnezzar reigned. It's a historical information of what we see. Remember, Daniel's not old here. He's not a 50-year-old man. He's a young man at the beginning of this, so he doesn't have a huge life experience to draw from. He's learning, but we see what God does with him. And that's what gives all of our children an understanding that, you know, you guys are part of this church as well. There's not an age where God says, oh, I don't work with you until you're 30 or 40 years old. He works with a lot of people really young, and we see several people through the Bible that he does that with. So let's get into this here in Daniel chapter 2. If you look at verses 1 and 2, here it says, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Then the king gave a command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dream. So they came and stood before him, before the king. So this was an incredibly superstitious people. They believed in being able to read these dreams, read different visions, and read the signs. And so they were a superstitious people. And it says, and the king said to them, I've had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servant the dream, and we will give you the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made as an ash heap. And so here, he's really putting them to the test. This isn't normally how they did. Normally what they would do, they'd tell him a dream and they'd say, okay, interpret this. Tell me what this means. This is the vision that I had. Tell me what I'm being told here. I don't know if he was catching on to what had been happening throughout the years or whether God moved him to change what he was supposed to do, but he goes, no. I know what you guys are doing. You just make stuff up. He goes, I'm going to tell you this, and you can make up anything that you want. I'm going to have to believe you because I don't have anything different. He goes, I want you to tell me the dream. He goes, tell me the dream, and then you can tell me what it means. And they go, this is impossible. No, nobody can do this. They go, you're sentencing us to death unjustly. This isn't fair because we can't do this. Give us the dream, and then we'll tell you what it means. And so he sticks to it. He makes a decree, says, okay, nobody can tell me what the dream is. And so he starts killing all these wise men. And he's going down the list, and they get to Daniel, and Daniel stops him and says, hang on, just a second. He goes, give me time. Let me go to my God, ask him what your dream was and for the interpretation. He goes, and I'll come back. I'll come back and let you know exactly what you're looking for. And so this is, if you drop down to verse 26, look at verses 26 through 35. It says, the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? And Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. In verse 29, he says, as for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while you were on your bed about what would come to pass after this, and he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, the secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king and that you may know the thoughts of your heart. You, O king, were watching and behold a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, and the chest and the arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, and its feet partly of iron, partly of clay. You watched while a stone cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet, of iron and clay, it broke them in pieces. Then the iron and clay, bronze and silver, the gold were crushed together, became like chaff in the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain, filled the whole earth. So Daniel tells him. Daniel is given this information from God of what he was going to be seeing, of what was going to take place. And I mean, could you imagine the king, the face on the king? You know, he wasn't expecting anybody to do this. In all reality, at this point, when he sends out that decree, he had no anticipation of getting an answer to what this dream was and what it meant. And so I'm sure his jaw hit the floor. Because this wasn't, David didn't just rattle off some vague things. I don't know about you, but I very seldom dream in the first place. But when I do, I wake up and I'm like, I remember dreaming. And I remember something happened and I have no idea what happened. He knew every minute detail of what the dream was. And he goes through it and explains it. He didn't just summarize it. He explained every detail of what King Nebuchadnezzar had saw in his dream. And so he had the king's attention at this point. He had the king's attention. And we understand today that this statue represents a prophetic vision. It's a prophetic vision of what is going to take place in the future, of what God is doing. And thankfully, we've seen much of it as history now. We've seen it actually play out. I can't remember which slide I was on. There you go. So in verse 36, he starts to give this interpretation here in verse 36. He says, "This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. Wherever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the birds of the heavens, he has given them into your hands and has made you ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron." And so now we have some specifics of this interpretation. And right here, he doesn't give the names of the second, third, or fourth kingdoms. We don't know those empires yet. But he does specifically tell King Nebuchadnezzar, he goes, "You're the head of gold. Babylon is this first empire. It's this first kingdom." And so we have a point of time established for this prophecy now. Because he does get specific here. Now, later on, we are given the second and third names. He does tell that to Daniel, and we're given that information. But we also know it through history. We've watched some of this play out. Daniel became a very important person. God used him, used this point as a springboard so that Daniel could actually have an impact not only on the Babylonian Empire, but we'll see that he transitions into the Persian Empire and he becomes a great advisor. So he spends the rest of his life in the Babylonian government until they're taken down. And so Babylon is this first major empire that we see take place all the way down through about 539 BC. And when we look at this area that Babylon ruled over, you can look at the map that I threw up there. Two of them, I put them side by side, so it made it a little bit smaller, so hopefully you'll still be able to see it. But one of them is a more modern rendition, a showing what it would have looked like today. So you can see more parts of Iraq, Iran, a little bit of parts of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Egypt. That's kind of the magnitude of the Babylonian Empire. And they were by far the smallest of these kingdoms that are going to take place. When we think about this, every time one of the kings come along, they want to expand the empire. So they not only take over what was already established, but they try to push those borders, and we'll see that this keeps growing little by little. And they end up pushing east, and then they go west towards the end, but we see that they expand, and it becomes a greater empire from what was established under the Babylonians. So we know through history, and as I said, later on in Daniel, God gives the name of the Medes and Persians, as far as what took place with that. I'm not going to get too much into the details of this. Mr. McNeely did a really good job with the Bible study series that he was doing to explain the Persians and the Medes and how that all played into the history. And so I don't want to get into that too much because it was all recently covered. But what we see here is this expansion. The Persians spread out farther east. And so you can see it, the map start traveling towards the east of building on to this Babylonian empire that they took over. And it's interesting that when we look at the size of the Persian empire, it dwarfs what the Babylonians had. So here we're looking at Turkey, Libya, and parts of Africa, all the way down through what is clipping modern day India. And so it's much larger area than what they were initially dealing with. And they conquered the people in Babylon that the Babylonians didn't even know that were there. As they moved east, they started opening up more and more of the world and recognizing that there were people over there. We'll talk about that a little bit with the Greeks too, because the Greeks just kept pushing and kept pushing and kept pushing. But the Persians, they did this a little bit and went that direction and conquered. And you can think about it, at this point, they didn't even realize that China existed. They didn't know that there was a body of people over there. And so we know historically that Japan and China had fairly large empires over there, civilizations that had been established and well, not well known at this point of these people, but they were well versed in what they were able to do and their capabilities and the strengths of their empires over in the far east side of Asia. And the reason that we don't get into a lot of that is because with the Bible is all based around what is impacting Jerusalem. If you watch, as we go through all four of these different maps of these empires that take place, it all revolves around Israel. It all revolves around God's Holy Land, the place where Jesus Christ is going to come back to when he returns. And so this is kind of what is, it's not that the rest of the world is being ignored per se, but this is the focal point. This is the important part, and this is why we take time to go through this and understand this. And when we think about the Persian Empire and what they were doing, they united the most diverse group of people. You think about, if you look at that map and see how much it spreads, they were dealing with very different cultures. They were dealing with very different religions, very different systems of government. And so as they spread, as they go through that, they kind of had to incorporate all of these people into their new system, their new society, this new culture, basically. And what was nice is they were able to keep this together because everybody was making money. What do people like? We like money. Back then they liked money. Today we like money. And so everybody was doing well under this Persian system, so they didn't push back too heavily. What we find is that they had free enterprise. Because they were all united under the Persian Empire, that there was this free trade. As long as you really basically abided by what the Persians wanted, they would continue down this and things would run smoothly. And so they had this peace that took place. Now, they were very different from the way that the Babylonians ruled. And it's kind of why David got pulled out. The Babylonians pulled people out. What would happen is if you weren't getting with the system with the Babylonians, they would uproot you, move you somewhere else, and then displace you. The Persians, they let everybody go back to where they wanted to be. They let you do your own religion. They let you do your own thing. But they said, you just follow under our rules. They thought if they kept everybody where they were, all happy and pleasant and with money, that they would fall in line. And it worked for the most part. We see that this trade was working. They had caravans that would travel back and forth on these trade routes. And so people were making money. They were living well. Everything was going smooth under this system. Even Daniel transitioned well. Daniel transitioned from the Babylonian Empire to the Persian Empire and became an advisor to the Persians. So if we look at Daniel 2, we start to see that these empires transition one to another. They followed each other. You can't get any more exact than the Persians conquering the Babylonians. So this kind of, I talked about this is our template. So this is why this is our template. Because God has given us an example of what happens and how it happens and how these different kingdoms gain control and how they transition. So when so here we have the Persians, which are represented by that chest and arms of silver. So they're still somewhat valuable, not quite as valuable as the head of gold, but the two arms kind of represent that, the Medes and the Persians, as they blend together Again, that was kind of what Mr. McNeely explained of how they kind of incorporated into to one body. But the Persians gained control over this area. They didn't just take over the Babylonian empires. They took over the Babylonian Empire, the Egyptian Empire, and the Libyan Empire. So we see them kind of spread down south into Africa, but also they push east. And so this expansion of what they're doing, and again, you know, they came in and they didn't just kill everybody off like the Babylonians. So the system was, when you're bucking that system, if the Babylonians couldn't just displace you, they just killed your entire army and then moved you around and hoped that there was no uprising. There was no uprooting with the Persians. They were the exact opposite. They left people in their homelands and kind of worked with them, worked with their own cultures and their own religions to get them to what they thought they would be happy, but under the Persian rule. And so it was a novel idea. It worked really well for them until they came up against the Greeks. Once they ran into the Greeks, then we start to see some different issues pop up. They never were able to get all full control of the Greeks. Through time, they would end up taking some of their smaller cities or colonies or whatever you want to call them at that point. But it was still this problem of where anytime they went up against the Greeks, they never could completely conquer them. And so this is what we have with Persia. Eventually, Persia would fall, as predicted in Daniel chapter 8. In Daniel 5, we have the fall of Babylon. If you want it, write down in your notes. We're not going to go through them today. Daniel 5 is the fall of Babylon. Daniel chapter 8 is the fall of Persian Empire here. This is where we start to get some of these specifically named by God. He gives us more of the information. Oftentimes we think of the movie 300 about this Persian army, a million man army coming up against the 300 Greeks. It's not 100% accurate. I can't remember how much we talked about this in the Bible study, but it was really more like 300 Spartans with about 700 Greeks. So it was still an extremely small army. The odds were completely against them. They estimate that the Persian army at that point would have been between 100,000 and 500,000 people. So it's still a very big difference between the two armies of what they were up against. But it is not the movie. And we know it's not the movie, but we know history takes place. The Greeks do lose that battle there, but they come back at the Battle of Marathon. And that's where the tides change. And the Greeks become victorious, and we have the fall of the Persian Empire. So Greece kind of comes out of nowhere. This wasn't an expectation. They didn't see this power rising. And a lot of the understanding of that comes from these examples, the descriptions that God gives us. We'll actually get more into that with chapter 7, because chapter 7 gives us a whole different look of these empires, which is really unique, and I like going through that. But we're going to look at that next time. So we have this Greek Empire who defeated the Persians, who ended up going even further into India than what the Persians did. This was under the rule of Alexander the Great. And once Persia was destroyed, he continued to push east. Alexander would have been in his early 30s at this point, so He would have been young and vibrant. Young at that time, lifespans were much smaller, so I guess he wasn't young, but young to us. Young to me, because now I'm older than that. So young. But as he goes through that, he kept pushing. He was actually part of his own downfall, because Alexander was so ambitious. He kept pushing, just kept conquering. They were defeating everybody. He kept going. He wore out his army. He just flat out just ran them until they revolted. His army goes, listen, we've had enough. We haven't seen our family. We haven't seen our homes. All we've done is conquer people. And so they revolted. He had an army of, they say, between 30,000 and 50,000 people. And that's a much smaller army than what we were just talking about with the Persians. Yet they were still able to conquer them. And part of that to do when we think about the cities at this time, they were much smaller. They didn't have massive armies in each little city. So as they came in, they were able to conquer the people. And so part of what it was that Alexander was doing is just he kept pushing because as soon as they conquer somebody, you go, well, there's more people. And they kept pushing and kept finding more people. And that's kind of this idea that they had no idea this whole other civilizations existed to the east. But as Alexander found more people to conquer, he just kept going. He just kept expanding his empire. And so he thought eventually he would stop when he got to the end of the world. We know he didn't get to the end of the world. He just kept pushing until his army couldn't take it anymore. And so they moved and moved, and no matter who they defeated or how far they went, he wasn't happy. And so they finally turned back after the total destruction of the Persian Empire, and you can see in the map that they pushed even further into the India of what we know the people over there. He actually made it all the way far as the Indus River, and it's important because this really plays into the development of that whole area of what he did and the impact that he had. Because Alexander the Great, as he pushed these different areas, he spread Greek culture everywhere where he went. So you remember the Persians left everybody. The Persians left them, said, hey, you do your thing, just don't disrupt the system, and we're all okay. You keep paying your taxes to us, we get our money, you get your money, everybody lives, we're all under the same empire, no problem. No big deal. But what they wanted everybody to be under Greek culture. They thought everything that wasn't Greek culture was inferior. It was sub-culture. It was below them. And so as they conquered, this Greek culture spread. It just became a dominant force, and which actually has a really big impact on what we see, not only to today, but to the people in the first century. And we will see this in the development at Christ's time of how all of this takes place. So when we get to the first century, we see this fourth kingdom. It's kind of this amalgamation of all the other kingdoms put together because they just kind of keep getting built on top of one another. It's another reason that we use Daniel 2 as this template because it lays out this history for us, showing the impact that each of these cultures has all the way up until we get to that fourth kingdom. And so this has a profound effect on the church even. If we think about how much this impacts us on Judaism, and we talk about Hellenization. Sometimes that word gets thrown out. We don't know what that exactly means. Hellenization is just Greek culture. It just means the spread of Greek culture, which has a really large impact. So after Alexander the Great's death, his empire ends up breaking up into four parts. These four parts, you can see up on the screen, it's Egypt, Syria, Macedonia, and also Pergamum. And so we have these four. It's actually some of his generals that end up getting into a big fight trying to take control. They couldn't agree on who was going to take over, and so they fight for these different parts, or they fight for the whole control, and it ends up breaking up into these different parts. And it's important because two of these are going to be main players for many years down the line and going to really impact Israel. We're going to see them have a big impact on Israel. Because what ends up happening, the two important ones are the Ptolemies who conquered Egypt and the Seleucids who took Syria. We know this because they do end up showing up later in Daniel. But we also know that the Ptolemies were in Egypt for a very long time. They had a big part to play in the history of Egypt. If you think about Cleopatra, she was there when Julius Caesar showed up, which is a very long time after this, so of when all this takes place. So we're talking, 44 BC to this is about 323 BC. So a couple hundred years is of when this will take place. If you think about it, Cleopatra was not Egyptian. She was Greek. She was Greek. The Greeks had ruled Egypt from this time and until the Romans came in and took it over. And so we see how big of an impact this had. But it's important to understand is that for 150 years, the land between them became a battleground between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. They just continued to fight back and forth and back and forth. And what we end up happening is that, so if this is kind of jumping back a little bit. With Persia, if you remember, the Persians sent the people back to Jerusalem. They sent them back to rebuild the temple. And so they go back and do all of that. And in the book of Malachi, what we end up finding is that God is chastising them. He's kind of getting on them for not sticking to what they're supposed to be doing. He's getting on them. And then we don't have anything written in the Bible until the first century. We kind of have this time gap that we don't have anything happening biblically for roughly 400 years. And we don't see anything else written. And it starts to make a lot of sense when we look at history. We see what takes place and what happens. Because as the Ptolemies and as the Seleucids fight back and forth, they keep pushing north and south. If you think about where Egypt is and where Syria is, that land, that strip, that Israel becomes this battleground. And it's really neat because what we find is that sometimes they left remnants. And so archaeologists now find lots of things between the two different groups of people, the two different cultures, because they each had two different systems of money. And so they find different pieces as they're discovering, as they're doing excavations and working through the archaeology. This is actually one of the coins that they would have found. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. This is one of the coins that has his face on it. This is just one of the examples of the many different coins that they would have found at that time as they go through there. And I bring him up. I'm not going to get into him. We were talking actually before services. If you remember 2 years ago, I gave a sermon and I talked heavily about Antiochus Epiphanes and the impact that he had. He's the one that came in and actually set up an idol of Zeus in the temple. He forbade anybody to keep the Sabbath. He actually forced them to eat pork, unclean foods. He outlawed circumcision. Anybody caught with a Torah was killed on the spot. He was this cruel, cruel man when it came to keeping God's laws. He made it basically impossible to live according to God's standards. And so we see that he had this huge impact. He literally tried to destroy Jerusalem. We know that there's this big fight, and we see that in the Maccabees, that's why there's this revolt that takes place, and this is kind of that period where we don't have any biblical information. The Maccabean revolt takes place, and about 164 BC, they throw out the Greeks and kind of try to reestablish their homeland. It's no longer this battleground between the people. It's still a celebrated holiday for the Jews today of when they were able to take back control. They celebrate Hanukkah every single year as a reminder of their history, of where they've come from. And it's for them, it's a reminder of this gap in the Bible. It's a reminder of this time period that we know of. And that's really why we don't find anything in the Bible. It's this section of time that they're just getting beat up on back and forth from two different sides, and they're not even involved in it. They just become basically the battleground of it. And so for generations, there's this short period of time where they are free again. They're able to push back, and the Maccabees set up a system of government, and Judah had freedom again for this period. So when we get back to this statue, when we think about, if you remember back, I didn't put another picture up, the Greek section of the statue was the belly and thighs of bronze. And they ruled over the known world at that time, kind of taking in the effects of the previous two influences of the Persians and the Babylonians, and basically just trumping everything they did and saying, no, our culture is much better. This is the system. This is the way of life that you should be using. It goes, everything else is inferior, and they wanted to try to destroy that and replace it with Greek culture. And so that was their goal of getting rid of every ounce of Persian culture that they had. And we watched this take place, and that's exactly what they did. As they marched through, they started Hellenizing everywhere they went. Until they eventually, like I said, his own army rejected what he was doing. So what we see prophesied in Daniel 2, we see this step-by-step-by-step actions of God saying, hey, this is the plan that's going to take place. We're going to start out with the Babylonians, King Nebuchadnezzar is this head of gold. He goes, and you're going to get ruled by a different empire, and then you're going to get taken over by another empire. And so he works through this. The Babylonians, the Persians, and the Greeks were all mentioned by name in the book of Daniel. The fourth one we are not given. We are not given that information as exactly who they are. But that's why we use Daniel 2 as this template. That's why it's so important for us to understand this vision that King Nebuchadnezzar has been given and this interpretation that Daniel has been given by God, is because without this, we have no idea what any of the other stuff means. We're completely lost when it comes to actually understanding who it is, because if we only had Revelations 13 and 17, we would just be making stuff up. We'd just have to make stuff up. And we were joking beforehand, somebody threw out, yeah, that's what people do anyway. And yeah, that's right. There are a lot of people who just make up big chunks of it, even though we have this template. But a lot of that goes back to that blinding. We know that they're blinded. And so we have this consistency of these four empires that come in a row. The next one to come down the line is Rome. Rome ends up conquering Greece, and Rome is still present there in the first century when Jesus Christ is born. Josephus writes about this, and he was adamant that this fourth kingdom was the Roman Empire. So even a Jewish historian who lived during that time understood that that's who the Romans were, that they were this progression as God was leading these different empires down the line. And so all the way up to this expectation of the Messiah, what do we always talk about? Why the Jews were so upset and couldn't understand who Christ really was is partly they were waiting on this conqueror. They knew these four empires came down the line, and then when the Messiah came, they were expecting a conqueror. They were expecting for him to take control, him to be the ruler and the king. And that's not what they got the first time around. It is going to take place. The vision shows that. He explains exactly how it's going to happen. They didn't understand at that time, and the Jews today still don't understand that there are additional steps that have to take place before we get to that implementation of that new empire, of the kingdom of God. So that's where we kind of start getting into this here. Rome became the biggest of the empires, but it expands a different direction. They didn't push east like the Greeks did. It expands, takes much of North Africa, and expands up into France and Germany. But if you really look at this map here, you can see that's a very different direction. Rome never ended up pushing and taking the core of the Persian Empire. It was something, they tried it a couple different times, pushed that direction, and ended up that they were losing too many people, too many battles, and they just kept butting heads and butting heads and butting heads. They couldn't get through, and so they ended up kind of giving up and quit, kind of did the, all right, we'll quit messing with you if you quit messing with us type of thing. That I guess it's one of the first peace deals of that time would be between Rome and Persians. And so they give up on trying to go that direction. And so it really has this big impact in this Western part, this Western civilization that we know, using the foundation of that Greek model. And that's why the Greek Hellenization period is so important, is because that was a basis for the Roman Empire and the impact that they have. Because Greece had already spread through much of that area, they'd done all the legwork for it. It's the main language through all those areas, merchandising, selling, buying. It was all primarily done in Greek. One of the major proofs of how dominant that impact was, in the third century, the Jews ended up this, so this isn't the Greeks, the Jews ended up translating the Bible, so the Old Testament, what they had at that point, they translated the Bible into Greek, as that's known as the Septuagint. I imagine many of you have heard of that. So that's how dominant, how much of an impact Greeks had. It's the only time that the Jews translated the Bible into another language other than Hebrew. So this must have been a driving force, this culture that had taken over. And why would they have done that? It's because that was the main influence. That's what everybody spoke. That's what everybody knew. That's what they were reading. And so we see that that's one of the proofs that the Jews would have gone to the extent of actually translating the Bible into a different language. And we see that impact. So we have, what we have is this Western civilization pulling away from any type of Eastern roots. It's really a very different, as you can get into thinking about how the Eastern part of Asia acts versus the Europe and the Eastern part of Asia, actually. There, you can see some shifts there as well. But it ends up with very different religions, ends up with different music, different culture, different arts. So you see these two dynamic cultures of what we see in India today versus what we see in Europe. That's a lot of to do with Rome not pushing that direction, not going any further, not carrying on with what Alexander the Great did down that direction. And so here we have this fourth beast. We're kind of going to jump forward a little bit. We're up to about 37 BC. We have Herod the Great who comes along. He ends up refurbishing the temple. So that when Jesus comes along, you think about the temple that Jesus, Peter, Paul, John, Mary, all of them, when they come along, this isn't Zerubbabel's temple. This was a completely refurbished, a refined, it was a larger, it was a nicer, more expensive temple that was completely refurbished by Herod the Great. He spent a lot of money and a lot of time in rebuilding this temple. And so it's something different than what they would have seen at Zerubbabel's time. We get to the point where Jesus Christ is born approximately 3 BC, around 6 AD. Herod ends up dying, and this has a pretty big impact because when Herod dies, this area comes under a Roman governor. Christ was crucified by Pontius Pilate in 31 AD, and 70 AD, the Romans end up destroying the Jerusalem and the temple. We see this big fight. Over time, the Roman Empire begins to weaken. They slowly weaken to their fall in approximately 476. We're gonna talk about that because this fall isn't a fall like we've seen with the other empires. It's different. So when we think about our statue, when you think about how it was built, all the different parts. So if you remember, it was described with these two legs of iron and these feet that are mixed with iron and clay. When you think about that, it's really this horrible mixture, this nasty mixture. So we have skyscrapers that are built with iron frames, iron bases. So they're extremely strong, extremely sturdy, withstand a lot of. And then you have these feet, which are the base of this entire, all of these empires, this mixture of iron and clay. What's going to happen? It's going to become very unsturdy, very quickly, very fragile. And so we see that this final empire actually has a lot of strength and a lot of power, but at the same time, it's really weak. There are these weaknesses in it. And part of that goes to this time, because no matter how hard Rome tried, they couldn't ever unite everybody. They couldn't ever get all the people on the same page. They couldn't get them to work in unison. As bad as they wanted to, it was one of the fatal flaws that they had. They never had this strong, strong peace. Now, they did have peace for those who were with the system, this ideas, but for much of it, they were either fighting incursions from the outside or rebellions from the inside. They were constantly being pushed on. And so they never had lasting peace that was just gentle and that would just carry on like the Persians did. Now the Romans tried to force this upon everybody. They tried to work through this. And so they had this battle where, you know, Persians had decades of peace, and Rome was kind of forcing it down people's throat. And if you were with the system, things went well, but when it didn't go well and they had these uprisings, they squashed you. It's kind of that iron part of the statue. They ruled with a rod of iron, and they came down hard and heavy, and they destroyed any of these incursions or rebellions, but that's tiresome. If we're we're constantly fighting battles in our life, constantly having friction. We just feel wore out. We're just tired, exhausted. It's amazing how mentally draining things are, and that makes it physically draining at the same time. And so they were dealing with this as an empire, as a government. And so this mixture, they ruled by this sheer force. They did have free enterprise, free trade. You could cross any of those borders that you needed when you were trying to get to different places, as long as you were going under that Roman system. As long as you were under that system, everything was good. They would leave you alone. Things would be at peace. And we see that even with a lot of Jesus Christ's time and what they did. You know, the Romans kind of policed to make sure there were no riots or anything going on, but they let things be. They let the peace happen as long as there was peace. And so they always had this strength, but always had some underlying weaknesses. They couldn't make everybody love them. That's some of our goals, right? We want everybody to love us. We want to be favorites to everybody. They wanted to do that, but it just didn't happen. They couldn't ever make everybody like them. So the legs of iron suggest that they had the strength. As iron would do, they would smash and break and crush anything that they needed to continue their peace and continue their system. But they were always a divided kingdom. And it's important to understand that when we said that the Roman Empire fell at 476, I told you I'd get into that a little bit more. The entire kingdom didn't fall in 476. The Western Empire fell in 476, but the empire kind of split into two parts at that time, a kind of resemblance of these two different legs. That's why it's always neat to go through what God gives us, because we see how methodical he is with some of these visions and what they actually mean. The Eastern Empire, which ended up ruling out of Constantinople, it didn't fall until roughly the 1400s. So we had this huge period where it wasn't until the 1400s that the Ottoman Turks ended up finally destroying the eastern side. But the western side fell at 476. But during this time, even though they fell much earlier, there were always this resurrection. There was always groups that kept coming in trying to resurrect this empire, trying to get it going again. There were multiple attempts over the years, but nobody could end up doing it. And one of the reasons that they couldn't get it done is because a lot of these people started finding their own identity. What does that mean, finding their identity? Well, French people wanted to be French. Germans wanted to be Germans. They were themselves. They started wanting to be their own people. And so it became even harder at that point to convince people that, you know, they didn't want to be Scandinavian, they wanted to be Roman. They wanted to be under that whole system. But they wanted to be independent. And so as we see groups come in and try to resurrect the Roman Empire, unite everybody, it continued to fail. It just didn't happen. Even though there were these multiple attempts. We think about Charlemagne tried to do it. Charles the Hammer tried to do it. We talk about the Holy Roman Empire, and it's kind of funny because it wasn't holy and it wasn't Roman. Neither one. But it was really a group of dozens and dozens of German states that tried to unify this. And they actually didn't always all get along. There was a lot of infighting that would happen amongst them because as normal groups of people do, they want control and they want power. And that's why we see the empires roll through. But for the most part, they kind of got along with themselves. And so they tried to resurrect this empire. They tried to get it going again. We see this all the way down. They never could do that. And even though that we have these different times that happen, but when we look at history, you know, Napoleon tried to do it, all the way down through Hitler and Mussolini, we just continued to see this trying to resurrect this empire, the strength of the Roman Empire, create this Roman Empire again. And no matter what would happen, they could never get this Pax Romana. That was that Roman peace that we've talked about in the past. For those under that system, it worked well, and things were good. In Rome, they had this idea that they wanted to bring this peace to the world. They thought everything would be great, and they couldn't figure out, and they couldn't understand why people wanted to just get on board with the system. It was that independence of each of these groups of what they wanted and what they were doing. But this idea that these leaders had of trying to resurrect this, it's really an intellectual enlightenment. They're saying, our system is better than yours. Our culture is better than yours. Everything else is inferior. And so we see these leaders who have that mentality, that mindset, as they try to reestablish and resurrect this Roman Empire. And so it never really goes away. It never fully dissipates. And we have these two parts. Two parts still basically exist today. They're still there. The Eastern European side, we have like Poland, Ukraine, Romania, Hungary, that kind of area. And then we have everything else on the Western side that we have. So we still see these two groupings. When we look at it, a lot of times we like to play in Bible prophecy and look and see what's going on. For years and years, we've talked about this European Union. You know, we watch Great Britain break off, and we watch these things play out, and we keep going, oh, we're watching it. This has happened. Is it going to be the European Union? I doubt it. There's a lot of changes that still have to take place. Whatever the reconfiguring is, there's going to be some changes that have to happen with it. But there's going to be these constant ideas to reunite these people, to resurrect this empire that's going to be there at the return of Jesus Christ. And so it's interesting to watch this, and it's good for us to watch this. It's dangerous if we start jumping to conclusions, though. And that's why I always am really careful with the information that I give about prophecy and why it's so important to look at the templates, use scripture as our base, and say, what can we prove definitively? And what is it that we need to watch closely so that when it does happen, we go, okay, I see God working. And this is where we get into this of watching these attempts to resurrect this Roman Empire, this power that's going to be had at that time. And so we have these two branches of the empire exist at the timing of the return of Jesus Christ. So it's not just a matter of looking back and saying, okay, we have these four kingdoms. It's this process down through history that God has been working on. There's more to it than just the strength of that Roman Empire. And that kind of plays into why we see the impact that it is. Because it's the feet of this iron and clay mix, they really never gel together. It's really never a solid foundation, a solid base. And so, at the beginning of the empire, they're strong. They have that strength. But towards the end, which is the base of that statue that we see in the vision, that's towards the end of time, and they just can't stick together. They can't get it figured out. And so we have this prophecy that's showing that there's this vulnerability, this weakness in this empire. And kind of remember that all of this is revolving around Jerusalem. That is our focal point. With this prophecy, we don't see any of the English-speaking peoples brought into this. We don't see, it's very much tunnel vision when we see God's prophecies, because it's very specific about what he's talking about. He's talking about Jerusalem. He's talking about Israel. He's talking about these points where we know these big events are going to take place. We know where Jesus Christ returns to. So we know what this is going to, why he's doing some of these things and how it takes place. And so we see this weakness of the Roman Empire, that whatever it is, it ends up being resurrected here towards the end of time. But we get to a point that has this lasting kingdom, something that lasts forever. It talks about a stone cut without human hands. He's basically saying, you have no involvement in what takes place at this point. As human beings, we have zero involvement of crushing all of these empires, taking over this rule, taking over these kingdoms. We don't bring down this statue. God does. God does that. When Jesus Christ comes to take his rightful throne as King and Lord, he will reestablish governments. He will reestablish a government. And it says, none of our governments are used. It's one of my favorite scriptures. It was, it's either Daniel 35 or 36. We read it a little while ago. It says all of the governments are going to be like chaff in the wind, just blown away. That means nothing of our human governments are going to be used. Nothing of our thinking, nothing of how we think things should play out are going to be used. God has a system that is so perfect that we have no idea what that means. We have no idea what that's going to look like. And so here in this example, he gives us 10 toes, which are going to be really important later. We're going to get into a little bit of that. But at the end, this kingdom really just doesn't work. It can't solidify. And so this entire statue is broken. It all comes crumbling down and it's crushed. Everything's blown away. If you hop back into Daniel chapter 2, if you look at verse 41 now, he says, whereas you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed in ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron, partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. It's the problem that the Roman Empire had since the very beginning. They couldn't get everybody on board. Eventually, the nations wanted to be their own people, have their own systems of governments, have their own culture. They didn't want to all be the same. And so they could only last so long fighting these battles all the time. They could only last so long being able to try to hold everything together. And then in verse 44 says, and in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces, consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king, what will come to pass after this? The dream is certain and its interpretation is sure. He's saying, I've got this. Because I am in control. So we have this prophecy that reaches from Daniel's time all the way down to the return of Jesus Christ. Now there's a lot of gray area in the midst of there from the first establishment of the Roman Empire to what's going to happen. You know, we've got a couple thousand years now where every generation is going, it can't last any longer than this. Can't tell you when it's going to be resurrected. It may be my lifetime. It may not be like my lifetime. All I can tell you is you better be ready. God is very clear about being ready. Being ready and being ready. It's interesting. Some of the words, the examples that he gives us. One of my favorite ones is he talks about it being like birth pangs. Do you go from not being pregnant to having a baby instantly? Nope. You've got 9 months of caring and nurturing and feeling the back pains. I don't know. I haven't ever felt the back pain. I'm just sympathizing with my wife. She's giving me the dirt. I knew I was going to get a look for that one. I didn't carry the baby, but I know the pain that she went through. Empathy for her. I'm not making up for anything, am I? No. We know. We all know, even if we don't feel it. We know the struggles that you ladies go through for all of us. But he uses that example that it's not a surprise. When you get to the end of 9 months, you know you're getting real close. You know you're almost there. And sometimes it comes a little earlier than 9 months. Sometimes it comes a couple weeks later than 9 months. But we know it's going to happen relatively close to that time. And we watch some of these play out and start to get better. And then it gets worse again and starts to get better. Actually, one of the things that we're dealing with right now is one of the weaknesses that the Roman Empire dealt with. One of the things that they had a problem with was currency. Under the Roman Empire, they didn't have a common currency. So what ended up happening is everybody made their own currency, whatever they wanted. What happens when you influx a whole bunch of money into a system? We've watched that, haven't we? We live in that system right now. There's been money dumped into pockets. As money gets dumped into pockets, what happens to prices of things? Goes up, right? Because everybody's got extra money. When you got extra money, the cost of things goes up. That money becomes worth less as there's more of it. And so they were dealing with this. They didn't understand economics. They didn't understand how the system worked. And so as people just kept creating more and more of these things, the prices there kept going through the roof. And so it created this imbalance. And so they dealt with this. All these little towns and provinces under the Roman Empire, they dealt with inflation on massive scales. And it just crushed them at times. Now, this is one of the things I don't think that the Roman Empire of at the end time is going to deal with or have problems with, because we have currencies now that are established. And right now we're watching the government raise interest rates to try to counterbalance the inflation rates. So we have an understanding of economics where I don't think this will be a problem. But under this human mindset, we know that this Roman Empire has issues. Now, they also have a massive amount of strength. They're going to have a military strength that they are backed by. We'll get into that a little bit more when we get into Revelation in a couple of weeks. But this is a framework that God has given us so that we can understand what it is that we're going to read in Revelation. When we get to the mark of the beast and what that means for us and why it's important for us to be ready and be on our toes, it's important to understand this foundation. God lays it out with history of what we go through with this vision of Nebuchadnezzar. But he's doing all of this so that he's showing us, I'm in control. That's all God's showing us with this, really. You know, we don't need to know this information to get to the point of salvation. If we didn't have any of this information, Jesus Christ is still going to return. It doesn't change any of that. But this is just more proof to embolden our faith to say, God is in control. God is working out this plan. We don't have to panic. We don't have to get upset. Now, human nature, things happen in our lives. We get upset. We do fear the unknown at times of what's taking place. And that's just part of the reality of being humans and trying to survive to the next day. Sometimes that's what it feels like, isn't it? Surviving to the next day. We're just trudging through and we're hoping tomorrow is better than today. But God has this under control, and we can let some of that anxiety and some of the issues that we have as humans that prevent us from living well in understanding these prophecies. We can let that stuff go because we know God is in control. He goes, watch my plan. That's why I think he has given us some insight into his plan so we can see it work out. We've seen it work out. We've seen everything come true so far that he's saying. We're just waiting on the rest of it. We're just waiting on him to finish it. And so as we go through Daniel, I hope you view this from the standpoint of using this to help your faith, not as a salvation issue of us putting dates and stamping that this is the exact time or this is the exact group of people or this is who's going to be in control of how this happens. It's not the point of prophecy. The point of prophecy is to show us that God never loses control. His plan will always hold true. His plan is going to always hold true. And so that's where we're going to stop for today. Next time, we'll go through Daniel 7. It shouldn't take near as much time, but we get into some really cool things in Daniel 7 because he uses very different characters than what we see here with the empires, and they resemble a lot of what we see. So it shouldn't take as much time because we've gone through a lot of the historical base, but this is what we're doing. We're going to set this foundation because God has given us a template. We just have to use that template to show exactly, sorry, I didn't move that last one, to use the final point of showing what it is that God's taking us to.